Welcome to Prime for Growth, a podcast about the journey of possibility that entrepreneurs live every day. Our conversations with these everyday innovators explore why, when, and how they implement change in their businesses, and sometimes what happens when they don't. I'm your host, Angela, and I've been working with entrepreneurs while growing a financial services company for more than two decades. I've learned a lot from our clients over the years, and I hope you will too. Thanks for joining us on Prime for Growth. Quote that fit really well with today's episode: never let success get to your head, and never let failure get to your heart. We know being an entrepreneur involves trying and failing, but how do you overcome failure and the chaos typical of high-growth companies? Our guest today invested heavily in process implementation, turning bootstrapping into scaled opportunity. Jody Scarlett began her business ProStar Cleaning and Restoration as a local home cleaning business. We discuss how tempering the entrepreneurial go factor using a process framework actually enables more creativity, innovation, and growth. Jody's a big intuitive thinker and decision maker, so we start today talking about how a leadership personality carries through everything you do.
Well, I try and be largely the same person, Angela. I think authenticity is really important. My family certainly thinks I'm a lot like I am at work at home, quite directive and bossy a little bit. So a leader at home and at work. Let's go with that.
What was it about those characteristics? Did you always have those characteristics in your life?
I think it is kind of always who I was, although maybe I didn't always embrace it as much as I do now. I think we come into ourselves. I certainly have with a little bit of experience. I certainly didn't have the confidence in my ideas. I remember times in university when, you know, sitting in the back of the class, not saying the answer, thinking the answer was obvious, that everyone knew it. But I had a professor talk to me about it, and one of my mentors, and he said, you know, Jody, not everyone knows the answer. You do, though. You should speak up. And I think I've always been like that, had the ideas and the answers, but I've learned with experience to speak up.
So when you're stepping into your role as a leader at ProStar, what's the best thing about those attributes, that leadership quality, and how would you define that? Like, what are the personality traits that you think kind of fall in behind that?
You know, I've thought about this a few times. You know, I can think of, you know, decisions that I made, you know, many years ago. Like one time we decided to move out of our building into another building. And I remember a good friend of mine that, you know, was always involved sort of talking to me about the business. He said, why are you making this decision? Like, this is a ridiculous decision. And then, you know, a year later, he's like, you know, I was wrong about that. That was a good decision that you made. Think of that just as an example, because we needed to move. Like, we needed not to be in that 200 square foot room in somebody else's building. Like, we needed our own space, our own lease. It was just an example of really knowing what I knew, you know, even when others sort of disagreed, or people that only knew it on the surface disagreed. And I think that's sort of the character trait that your question is getting to, is just this confidence and to be different, not to do what everyone else is doing, like to take a new approach, to overcome obstacles a different way, to go around, like not just to give up when I hit a roadblock or a wall. And I think that that's really the leadership quality, which is just sort of this weird dogged determination, stubbornness, some might call it, but it can be annoying to my team sometimes, you know, but at the end of the day, like over time, people that, you know, work with the leadership, they see that that particular trait and quality is sort of central to change and innovation in the business.
XP Insight conducted a study in North America of more than 5,000 leaders across a spectrum of industries. They defined five core characteristics that leaders whose companies were innovative had in common compared to their counterparts in non-innovating businesses. The characteristics were managing risk, wielding curiosity, leading courageously, seizing opportunities, and maintaining that all-important 10,000-foot strategic perspective of their business within the bigger market. The only key measure that these innovative leaders scored lower on than their counterparts was their ability to maintain order and accuracy. But even that delta wasn't as large as the gaps on the other metrics. What that tells me is that if you're a leader whose instinct is to ensure that things are done first in an orderly way, you might be preventing some innovation from flourishing inside your business. So talking about that sense of self-confidence to say, I have an idea and I'm actually willing to test it and try it. And if it fails, that's okay. I'll fall down 8 times, get up 9. Always the sense of tenacity. Would you say that those were really important in your formative years of starting your business? Tell us about that journey of where ProStar came from.
I don't know if I knew that then, like hindsight being 2020 for sure. But I think it's always been there. But as the years have gone by, because I've been at this 19 years now, as the years have gone by, like the decisions have sort of piled up where you sort of see like the attempts, the failure, the dust your knees and getting to success, or, you know, some things just didn't work, whatever, let's leave those in the dust. But lots of times I've certainly swung for the fences and hit it out of the park. So I guess over time, you know, when successes, they start to add up too. And I think that's where confidence has come from.
If you never take, you miss all the shots you never take. This sense of having the confidence, that what's that first step feel like though? Can you think back to a time when you were contemplating, we're going to move out of the building, and where you had doubt? How did you sort of quiet the doubt and allow yourself to try anyway, even though failure was one of the possibilities?
You know, I think there's just a stubbornness to me. Like I say all the time, like my team started saying this now, so I know I must have said it not 7 times, like for sure 70 or 700 times. But I always say, you know, we got to get that canoe in the water. We got to get that canoe in the water. Like I don't care if it has a hole in it. Like we'll patch it as we go. And I think that's kind of what you're talking about. How do you quiet the fears? Ignore them, maybe. I think if I knew now, like if I knew then what I know now, I probably wouldn't have taken some of the risks I took, you know, is the truth. A tactical strategy is I now have a business partner, you know, that joined me about 11 or 12 years ago now. And he really helped me manage risk in the business, which was really good because, you know, I'm a bit of a risk taker and I needed a bit more pragmatism. But sometimes those risks are just like, we got to get there. We got to go. I know where we're going. I don't know how we're going to do it all. We'll build the plane while we're flying it as needed. So I don't know what personality traits you're hearing in there, Angela, but I'm sure stubborn has to be on the list, or foolish, or risk taking, some of them.
I personally think one of the most valuable things a leader can do is to invest in self-awareness. As a leader, especially one vested with driving the innovation and competitive advantages in the business, knowing our gaps is just as important as knowing our strengths. If we are on the risk-comfortable side of the spectrum, but managing risk is a key success factor in innovation, as we heard earlier from our innovation leadership metrics, then we need to assure that attribute is somewhere inside our leadership team to help create that needed balance. Some of it is this sense of naivete to that confidence, where you could just say, I don't know what I don't know. And that might actually be a good thing.
I think you really summed it up there. Like sometimes you don't know what you don't know, but you have to. I mean, since the dawn of time, I'm a woman in a man's industry, you know, and since a very young woman in a man's industry. And if I listen to every naysayer that said, you can't, it's not done that way, it's not what happens, like the hundreds of times that I have been told that in my career, I mean, we'd just be nowhere. So what if I got it wrong sometimes? Like somebody has to blaze a new trail. Like, and I just, it has to be me, I guess.
When ProStar was starting out, it is not the same business model as what was conceived when you began it. And I think you've gone through a lot of iterations. Can you kind of sum up where the business started? What was the service model when you started the company? And then what imperative happened or opportunity that created the next iteration of ProStar? And how did you evaluate that? That was a kind of an innovation of product and services, a change, pivot in your market focus. What drove that decision from where you started?
Well, a variety of things over time. So just to take you back to the beginning, imagine my first day in 2002, and here I am in a 200 square foot room that I'm renting in someone else's building, you know, sewer love, brown carpets, one broken chair, like the wheel was sort of broken. I would sit crooked in my chair, and there was really only paper calendar on the desk with a few customer names, like not even their last names. Like, we cleaned for Marcy on Tuesday, you know, when I bought this business. You know, we had a 7 broken down Hyundai Accents, and somebody had at one point tried to make a database on the one computer in the room, and it was called the costumer database because it was misspelled. So, you know, it was a pretty ragtag little operation that we were trying to get started. And it was a cleaning business. You know, we just clean houses every 2 weeks. That's what we did. And it didn't certainly have this vision at that time. Like, I certainly didn't start the cleaning business envisioning like a $20 million construction restoration firm. Like, that was not in the plans. That evolved over time. And how did we get there? I mean, first iteration just started with, well, it was always profit driven. Like, we need to clean some bigger things, like revenue driven, right? We need to clean some bigger things. We need to do more. What can we do? What can we do? And then always this ridiculous idea, like that, like, I have this character flaw that I never think I can't. Like, it's a benefit and a curse.
You might call it a gift, not a flaw. Just saying.
Benefit and curse, though. Yeah. My husband would certainly say that it's a benefit and a curse. So we, you know, always just do more, do bigger. What can we do next? And well, then we were doing carpet cleaning, and the next thing you know, we were changing the name because we couldn't work under the old name with the licensing. So we wanted to do restoration, and we did restoration. Why can't I do construction? I mean, I was a city girl with an MBA. Like, I don't know what end of a hammer was what, yet somehow now today, like, we're building big buildings, and I have learned ins and outs of construction business, like full scale development now. So, you know, things have come along. Fortunately, about 6 or 7 years ago, we started doing entrepreneurial operating system in the business, which was a huge move to strategic planning. And I will say that from the days of just evolving of we should do bigger, we should do more, and, you know, whatever I dreamed up was next, we've moved into a far more strategic model of strategically planning, prioritizing what changes and innovations we're working on, and analyzing what risks a business has and how we're going to mitigate those risks with our strategic plan. So things have changed, but it used to be a lot more fly by the seat of the pants. And now it's a lot more planned and procedural and strategic.
EOS is the acronym for Entrepreneurial Operating System. It's a framework that helps growth companies align their team around 3 key priorities to help build a healthy growth business. Vision, or aligning the team around the same objective and the plan to accomplish it. Traction, that helps create a discipline and accountability to move towards the objective. And investing in the health of the leadership team so the organization can be effective in its work. Companies often use a coach to help them create a rhythm and to build this framework and enact it and help the team practice it as a strategic investment in the business. There are several well-known frameworks that help growing businesses with implementing systems and building disciplines other than EOS. A couple of other popular ones are called Gazelles, and the one that we use at Prime, which is called RES, or the Results Execution System. So what made you decide that that shift was necessary? Because I know exactly that moment in my business when we just knew that our franticness of reaction to things
was going to keep us in the proverbial hamster wheel, and we weren't going to be able to scale and grow. It just wasn't possible. For you, what was that imperative? What drove you to go to that, to adopt that EOS and implement it?
Well, you know, it was a bit of a different thing. Like, we had about 2 years before we put the EOS in, I had embarked with a consultant. We wanted to put in a core safety program and at the same time put in an ISO 9001 procedure system. So ISO had us documenting our procedures and we did that. But I found that it still wasn't quite, like, it wasn't giving me quite the organization that I wanted. Like, it was a good documentation step and it helped with some of the orderliness, but there must have been this deep sense, like, of what you're talking about, Angela, like this deep sense of it's just not quite clicking or running smoothly. Like, it's still sort of driven by whim and whimsy. And I've always been a member, well, we met in Women Presidents Organization. So I've always believed in mentorship through the WPO. When I started my WPO Platinum chapter, I noticed that a number of the other members were all doing this thing called EOS, which I was like, this big mystery, like, what's this acronym? What's this thing you're doing? So I read the books, Entrepreneurial Operating System. So I read the books and learned more about it and thought, you know, this is going to give more of a cadence to decision-making and strategic planning. Like, we had procedures before EOS, but we didn't have the kind of cadence of decision-making. And I really related to sort of the part in Rocket Fuel where they talk about the whole organization reacting to the whims of the visionary. So I'm the visionary and I always had all these ideas. We're going to do this and now we're going to do that. And then we're going to be over here. And they just couldn't keep up with it. Nobody knew what direction we were driving. I suppose seeing other successful businesses doing it paired with, you know, relating to some of the reading material really deeply.
Consequences of that whimsy style of business operation. Like, what was the impact on the people?
Well, I was always trying to put in more leadership, right? And I remember, like, thinking, how are we going to get these people on track to their goals? You know, we're not getting results. We've got to have these meetings, these goal setting and review meetings was a term I had learned, GSR. And I thought, I'm going to get these GSR meetings going. And I'd gone to our WPO meeting and told them that I was going to do this. Well, what's the timeline was one of the questions that came back. And I was like, well, what, next month? It'll be done by next month. And everyone laughed hysterically. They're like, this is a 2-year problem, you know, that you're embarking on, Jody. And I was like, 2 years? It won't take me 2 years. Surely it did take 2 years. And I've since that time noticed that everything after that has also taken 2 years. When we implemented a new backbone software, 2 years. When we implemented EOS, 2 years. And when we implemented the core system or ISO system, it was 2 years, like, in hindsight. So things are always taking longer than I think. And I think that's the impact to the organization is that, you know, I'm rushing to the next idea and not allowing things to germinate. I think that's where you're going with the question, like, what's the impact to the people, right? It's just the lack of traction.
And so would you say that has resolved now or you've cured it or is it changing slowly over time? Because you've been using the system for a while. I've seen you achieve remarkable operational efficiency and no business is perfect. There's moving parts that you can't predict. So I'm curious, when you implemented it, you knew that you would gain some value from it. What was the response of your team? Like, how did you have to socialize this with the team? If it took 2 years, probably the first year was getting buy-in and having people agree that it was needed because you're asking them to step out of their comfort zone. You're asking them to learn something that they don't feel is essential.
Well, funny story. So I came back from one of the WPO meetings and, you know, in true Jody style, I just said, like, we're doing this new thing, EOS. At our senior leadership meeting. And my business partner, Scott, he fully objected. He was like, we've done too many new things and we need a break from new things and no more new things. And I said, well, you know, we'll just do it here. It's really no big deal. It's just this sort of like meeting agenda. And all it means is that in these senior management meetings, I'm going to run the agenda a different way. That's all. Can you live with that? And so that was stage one buy-in, right? So senior leadership meetings. So I didn't have an implementer or whatnot at that time. So senior leadership meetings is just me trying to figure out how to run like an L10 style meeting. But it's funny because it starts with the first thing you do is you have to actually have a segue or a personal share at the beginning of the meeting. And I remember thinking back to how awkward that was. Like, we're talking a meeting of four people. Now, this is not a big group. And everyone has to say like maybe something they did on the weekend or something that they ate for dinner last night or, you know, something like that. And it was so weird to even like start with relating personally. And we just did that for a while. And we started doing the scorecard. We really liked the scorecard because my partner's really analytical and it added some structure to how my VP ops and I started relating to the material. And so it just started flowing. Like we were doing it at the senior management meeting and then gradually like they started to like it. And I said, well, you know, there's some grants. Maybe we could get a coach and, you know, do some training, you know, for some of the team. And, you know, they said, okay, well, that sounds good. And then, you know, I hired somebody to come and implement it a little bit more widely to the next, you know, layer out. So then we were at about 25 out of 75 in the organization. And then they kind of got into it. We did a retreat. And then the next thing, you know, it trickles down. So it took 2 years. Imagine that.
The 2 year rule. So do you think everyone else agreed that there was a problem in the business at that time?
I don't think they could have articulated it, but I think they certainly would have felt a sense of whiplash. You know, what are we doing now? Why are we doing this? Like, what's the direction? Like, I just don't think they could have articulated it beyond being busy. But I feel now when you have something to compare to, certainly now everybody is rowing at a cadence. It didn't work smoothly at the beginning, even with the system. Like you have to really commit. Like a lot of people I know have started this system and quit. But you know, I think that really sticking to it in hindsight, you can see the difference and identify that there was an issue, but they didn't know at the time.
Oh, if you put the frogs in the pot, you turn the water up really slowly, the heat up, they never know that they're in danger because they're just acclimated to the environment. When you hire new people now, do you think about your recruitment differently now that you've got this cadence?
Well, we've always been, and the system, we already had this component, but the system is really big on, you know, hiring, firing, rewarding, evaluating based on your values. And, you know, we've always done that. That was, we had that in place, I think, before EOS. But certainly one thing with EOS is we've reevaluated our values a lot more constantly and given ourselves permission to sort of adapt and adjust them. You know, I think our values are different than money. Like they're unusual. Like one of them is trust in best intentions. And that's defined in our organization as meaning that we know that the other people are working to the same end as us. And when I explain it to the staff, I would say like, you know, when a project manager picks up the phone to call the crew chief and say, why didn't you finish the baseboard in the spare bedroom? Did they yell at them or do they say what happened? And usually, you know, if you say what happened, the crew chief's going to say, well, that door was locked. You know, I couldn't access that room or something like that. Do we really need to, you know, jump on people or can we really trust in best intentions and find out what happened? And I think when we hire people that are willing to operate like that, you know, it always shows through. The customer reviews are funny because when they write back, they say, you know, your people are just so exceptional. Like they're never going to say your staff trusted best intentions, but they certainly talk about how exceptional and kind and thoughtful and conscientious the staff are. And I certainly see that feedback, you know, matching how we're hiring based on values.
That's a really good insight because it's not just systems and processes that were at the center. Do you think that the fact that you had that sort of people philosophy before you even tried to implement the systems, do you have a sense of whether you could have been successful without having that kind of core those core values already defined before you started to kind of implement and innovate this process, new kind of process system?
Well, I think it was because I was doing the hiring. And even though before it was even back in the days before it was articulated as clearly, I had the single point of hiring. Like if you were in a business where, you know, maybe that wasn't filtered through the same individual, I could easily see that going off track. But even when we weren't articulated, I remember one time doing a personal histories exercise at a retreat and going around the room and everyone was saying what they had, their little bit of their career background. And I learned in that moment that about 70% of the people in the room, of about 25 people, so about 70% of them had all worked in the hospitality industry at one point in their career. And I thought, you know, this is not an accident. I wasn't looking for that on their resumes, but I realized that I'm hiring on values. Like I'm hiring people that know how to service and help people. So was it an accident? Maybe. Could it be replicated without systems? I think people could do it by accident if they really knew what they were looking for, just couldn't voice it. But, you know, now we've grown and other people are doing the hiring. So good thing that we've got it written down somewhere.
And well, certainly if you have it defined and you know what the rules and the parameters are, is it easier to replicate? Do you find that your degree of success in hiring and retaining changed since you've been very methodical about that recruitment process according to values and the framework that you built around what kind of person will thrive inside of your business?
Well, hiring is imperfect, you know, in general. You know, so it's not perfect, but overall, some of the ways that we've learned to articulate and some of the great questions that we've learned to ask people are really telling. Like one of the ones that we talk about a lot, one of our values is make change, you know, meaning, can you take feedback? Can you make change? Like, are you a person that can see your part in any given situation and adjust? And there's some really good tactical kind of interview questions that we can ask around people's ability to make change. And, you know, if we ask people in an interview, tell me about a time when you had a conflict at work and how you resolved that, I mean, we can get these fake answers. Like if people can't admit a personal flaw or what they learned or be vulnerable, we're really not inviting them onto our team. And I would say that's made a world of difference.
When I was researching for this episode, change management and process management, I came across this concept of the dynamic of failure. It says that big, successful companies often get stuck in their thinking styles based on the success of the past. Now, that makes sense. But what was really interesting is they broke it down into four different areas that can become strategic Achilles heels for the companies. The first one is the blinders. The second is routines. The third they described as shackles. And the fourth are dogmas. Let me break these down for you a little bit. Blinders are the strategic frameworks that you've built over time that help you identify patterns. For example, who are your buyers and what is driving their decision making? But they can also prevent you over time because you become a devotee of those patterns or expert in those patterns. They stop you from seeing new opportunities or even risks in the market. Surprising new information can get distorted through the lens of this expectation and come in and fit into the pattern. So therefore you miss the new information altogether. An example of this is Firestone versus Michelin. Michelin had built these radial tires and done very, very well in Europe with these. And when they first entered the North American market, Firestone had a pretty commanding marketplace, had some complacency. They weren't really producing tires at full throttle, and they didn't really react quickly to this new entrant. Their expectation was their clients are going to buy tires in a certain frequency. Well, radial tires last twice as long as what Firestone was producing, meaning that the shift to radial could impact Firestone not just from the perspective of somebody buying a substitute product, but also if they turned themselves to radial, they're having to retool all their plants and potentially sell half as many tires. This is a big problem for a business. And so they sort of put blinders on and that this new competitor wasn't such a big problem after all. Obviously, that didn't turn out to be true. The second one is your routines.
these are the processes in your business or the way you've always done things. And managers and people within your team get comfortable doing things a certain way. In fact, we encourage them to be highly effective at their jobs and to find a way of doing it that's cost effective, that's time effective, and that allows us to compete on price and time in the market. But if you are stuck in the way you've always done things and you're not willing to change and consider new technology that's coming in, you just may be setting yourself up for failure. The third one is shackles, and this is in the form of relationships. What they say is, well, we all nurture and cultivate relationships. We know they're important. You need to have good relationships within your supply chain, your lenders, other people in your market, and especially your core clients. But they can also dull your sense of innovation because you may be reluctant to make hard choices that break the trust that you've embedded into those relationships. Boeing is an example of an organization that got trapped in this. When Airbus's new, more fuel-efficient engine was announced, it caught them really by surprise. They were years behind in innovation. And in order to accommodate a new competitive fuel-efficient engine model, they would have to rebuild their craft. That would require new certification, which is costly and time-consuming, new pilot training for all of their customers, and it could effectively put them out of the sales cycle for up to a decade while their clients, who often would have a single type of aircraft in their fleet, would have to cycle out of those to acquire the new one. So there's a lot at risk. So they compromised on adjusting the model to not disrupt these clients and their expectations. They did all this because they were concerned that delays in coming up with this new fuel-efficient engine model would disrupt them to the tune of about $35 billion in revenue. Unfortunately, with the crashes of the 737 MAXs, due to what we know now was a problem with software put in to mitigate the rush job that they did on these new engines, that's ultimately cost them so far over $100 billion. The last one to consider is dogmas, which is really ironic to me because a dogma is really a value gone bad. And when we talk about being an entrepreneurial organization, we always start with our values. And we're going to hear today about the values that are enshrined in recruitment and making sure that people are aligned based on value, not necessarily on skill set or experience. But sometimes over time, values become the press that you should no longer believe because it no longer serves you. They become enshrined and taboo to question. BlackBerry, for example, RIM, was a very slow, adaptive, technologically cycled business. They believed that they would do things in an engineered way, very slowly, very methodically. They also had a bit of a bias or a shackle to their customer base because, of course, you know they were serving a lot of government clients. But when Apple was coming along and putting out the iPhone, they really didn't see that consumer demand was going to start to drive a demand for changes in their product. And they kept on doing their methodical engineering cycle. And while Apple was putting out a new product every year, RIM was struggling to keep up. In 2009, they had 20% of the market share. That diminished down to nearly 0% in 2016 when they were acquired by a Chinese consumer goods company called TCL. So all of these four things, the dogmas, the shackles, your business processes and routines, and the blinders that are patterns that are no longer serving you in your business, can all contribute to failure.
How do you get the ideas that are going to fuel the next iteration of positive change inside your business that I think of as small I innovation? It's not artificial intelligence. It's not inventing in a whole new robotic process, but it's looking out in the marketplace. And of all the people I've known in my entrepreneurial journey, you're one of the persons that I think does that so well, is kind of look out in the market to see what you can adopt and adapt.
A few things. There's a few parts to it. I think it's a big question, but I like your characterization of small I innovation, the entrepreneurial conferences where you have a mix of industries. Also in industry conferences, but sometimes I find those a bit narrow and myopic, like just not enough ideas inside the industry. I get a lot more ideas when I look outside the industry. And then I get a lot of ideas about, like I listen to speakers, you know, and I listen to them talk about what the things that are going on. Like, I love listening about, you know, millennials. It's been, you know, the last 5 years, we've all been talking about millennials and millennial culture or artificial intelligence or, you know, how that impacts things. And as much as I think, well, how could that impact my business, you know, artificial intelligence? If you don't know, like for me, if I don't know what's going on out there, I can't have that armchair view. So I try and do that. And then I do this thing like my espionage tours. People are really great. Like, they let you into their businesses. You know, like I've traveled all over North America visiting with different restorers. You know, they've had me in their facilities. They've given me their paperwork, for heaven's sakes. You know, they've I've given them mine. Don't get me wrong. Like, we've equally shared and helped each other. We're out of market. So it's quite useful that way. But between all these things, like just really thinking about it and then looking really kind of far out of my market, I've been able to kind of put together best practices and sort of like a patchwork quilt, like this guy does this really good and this woman over here does this really well. And my vision is coming together. This is how I want to do it. And that, when you mentioned in the question, you mentioned, you know, we had put in place this contents process and how did that look? And, you know, there was a lot of parts to it. There was process parts, there was all kinds of things, and they all kind of got married together into a fairly cohesive change that we rolled out.
I love how you characterize it as espionage, but I think of espionage as requiring a lot more subterfuge. And I know you, you're direct, you're honest, and you're authentic. You merely ask and people are happy to share. And I love that there's reciprocity in that for you, that you also share your best practices and your ideas and your takeaways. An industry that is better makes its customers happier, which is better for the industry. So that feedback cycle, I think of helping others become better with their best practices. And when you're thinking about a problem that you're trying to solve, is there a process or a strategy you've employed within your business that allows you to really poke at that problem from a whole bunch of different perspectives? Like, what does that look like inside your business?
You know, not all problems are require innovation. Some of them just require problem solving, but in a way they have some commonalities in terms of what you're talking about. So a few things. One is that, you know, defining the issue can be a challenge because sometimes I think something's an issue and nobody else in my company thinks it's an issue. Like, we just had this week where I was getting after some of the staff about this problem that I was seeing about a service deliverable, and they just didn't understand why I thought this was an issue. And it took actually quite a long conversation for them to see why I was even digging in. So defining the problem, one sort of thing. The other thing is, part of that ISO system that we run has something called improvement opportunity reporting.
Change management is really important for a business. Typically, though, you have to think about change as not something that happens periodically with long periods of stagnation between it, particularly not in the pace of our economy today. Change is something you need to practice every single day in small ways, and small iterations of change practice within your team make them far more agile when it comes to something big, a substantial shift that you need to make in your business. Maybe we're seeing the consequence of the problem, but that's not the root cause. And I love that you talk about kind of distilling it down to that root cause. Is there a problem in your business that you have been unable to solve so far by doing those conversations?
Well, I think there have been a couple of things in the last few years, but we made really good progress in the last couple of years. So one of them was around, you know, the business is exceptionally cyclical, you know, in restoration. Like, it's freezing out. Okay, it's busy. It's raining out. Okay, it's busy. It's exceptionally cyclical. And then sometimes you have a catastrophe that adds to so you have to be geared up to handle these sort of large events. And then you have to scale right down a more skinny time. That cyclical nature of the business had been causing quite a few problems because, you know, you build your overhead and you've got these highs and lows and you're trying to sort of level the curve. And in business school, we think about how to offset seasonality. Like, if you have a lawn mowing business, you start a snow shoveling business to offset seasonality. Well, I had thought, like, how do we do this, like geography would help, like having a bigger basket would help was sort of what I'd been thinking about. And that's a hard problem to solve. Like a little local company doesn't become a national company overnight. And, you know, we did join a national franchise group to have a little bit more reach, but wasn't necessarily exceptionally changing the size of our basket immediately. So we decided that, we'll go to where the jobs are. You know, we have to make the basket bigger. So we just decided we're going to launch CAT services and remote large loss services, and without starting locations in a whole bunch of geographies, we will travel to the work remotely and find a way to use local resources paired with our internal resources to do this work. And that's gone really well. It was like an unsolvable problem that we've been solving.
What was the first job like? Was it just like a disaster? Because you thought, you know, it's like when you go away on holidays and you think it's going to be warm and it turns out cold. And then
we went to Smiths Falls, Ontario, and we dug in on this big job and we just figured it out. And, you know, it worked out. Like it worked out really well. We did a good product. We did a great service and we found out how to, it's actually kind of a neat skill and a bit of a secret sauce here, but we figured out how to be uniquely local from far away. Because we were the only elements that weren't local in the project, was just a couple of managers. Like when you actually think about a multi-million dollar building project, we were actually using all local suppliers, all local resources, all local, except, you know, basically three of us weren't local. And what we brought to the table was, you know, a deep understanding of insurance claims and the insurance claims process that, you know, wasn't going to be an expertise of the local contractors. Hmm. So by pairing those things together, the client got sort of this really great guidance and this really good project that was through the lens of an insurance claim. And they were supporting their local economy. And we've been able to replicate this. And it wasn't all perfect. You know, at the end of the day, the improvement opportunity report had many, many aspects to it. But we've done, you know, a dozen of these since that time. And they've just gotten better and better and easier and more systematized. And it's really fun. You know, I really like it.
So I'm sure the first time you said to your team, hey, I have an idea, they were like, oh no, here it comes. Jody wants us to up the company and do all this work at arm's length where we can't actually have any eyes on the job. How do you ensure that these new people understand your core values and that they're going to execute according to those, so that your job quality, that external performance in the customer's eyes, was still had that unique local flavor to it? How did you accomplish that?
Well, I think it was because the project management team, you know, and I are very closely aligned with the quality. Although the company was here, a couple of us, you know, were there. I think essentially, like, it comes from the leader. Like, the leader hires the trade, the leader fires the trade. And if the trade's not cutting the quality standard on site, there's another trade right behind them that will. And sometimes that costs a little more. And so that first project, as successful as some have been since, in terms of those costs, but we didn't compromise our quality and we learned a whole new skill. And we've learned to see in advance what the qualities are of sub trades that are going to live up to us, our expectations. You know, we can tell, like, they do their paperwork, they get their quote in, the way they communicate on site, the way that they work with us through the bidding process. You can almost tell who's going to be the ones that are going to match our values. It's just like a big interview. And luckily, I've been able to have people that have been able to replicate this and really have a good eye. I call one of our project managers the trade whisperer, because she really has a good eye for who's going to be a good subtrade. It all stems from, like, what we can train out and replicate inside our organization. Like, I can't worry about what's going on in these markets or locales, but what can we learn and what can we replicate in our organization? So we sort of have a way we do things, like, from the roles that, you know, who do we need on these projects? We need a project manager. We need a site supervisor. We need a safety coordinator, like, that people might need to take. And then, you know, we start to define and track what goes into those roles. Housing, like we talk about what we learn about all these things and we keep them in a learnings document, like in this situation, this worked, in this situation, this didn't work.
Have you found that in your team, often there are kind of people that like to have more fluidity and less concrete rules, and then people that really want the playbook and they want to live and die by the playbook? And how in your business have you got those people to work together collaboratively?
Yeah, that's so tough. You know, that I think I just have to go back to hiring though. Like I really can't have people on the team that aren't able to make change. So the full rigidity, like there is a, you know, continuum of rigidity, like the full rigidity probably isn't in my organization, especially they're not going to gravitate to restoration, right? Because restoration is so solving problems like of the moment. So we don't have too much of that. You know, but even within, you know, we're on one side of the continuum. We've got some that really like a process and some that don't. I've sort of looked at defining what are the key points in the process that cannot, like that can't be flexible. So I call them, like I love lingo. You might guess this by now. I just love like language and lingo. So we call them gates. And a gate is something that has to be a certain way before we go on to the next part of the procedure. So an example is like a work authorization. Like you can't do work without a work authorization. Like I don't care if you're, you don't like process. Like don't work for a customer if you haven't signed the work authorization. We have to have some kind of authorization to start work that says who's paying, or we really can't start work. In the olden days, like that wasn't the way. People would just be getting started and hoping for the best.
Yeah, I've seen some very, very large projects in your space and in related spaces where there is a lot of faith in relationships and faith in, well, they told me they would, you know, he's as good as his word. The problem is not everybody maybe is on the same page about that. Or when circumstances change, all of a sudden, people can't adhere to that. That's where that having a bit of a linear process with those gates inserted to prevent those tipping points. I love that analogy of gates, and I love that language as well. Do you find now that there's less impatience? You know, it's okay because I know it's going to take 2 years, and I know I got to get people on board. Do you find that now your horizon has changed and that your change management style is different than maybe what it was 10 or 15 years ago?
I'd love to tell you, Angela, that I am less impatient, but that would be a full lie. Like, no, I'm still totally impatient. I still, you know, optimistically want to think we can get everything done in a shorter time frame than we can. I probably temper it now, like, being impatient and being unrealistic aren't necessarily the same thing. So I probably temper things with a far higher degree of realism. But I would say that the strive and the drive are still pretty intense.
Jody bought a small cleaning service and turned it into a multi-million-dollar national disaster restoration specialist. From my experience watching her business grow over the last decade and more, Jody's superpower is really driven by her restlessness, but she's not a slave to it either, spinning off an endless series of next things. She studies where she can make an impact and drive both capacity and profitability, and then gets it down to a science. That's the magic. It's the science that is her small innovation, which is taking ProStar to the next level. Join us next time as we learn all about innovation in categories. Building a disruptive new business model takes a lot of fortitude and a lot of time and dedication devoted to educating the market. If you can master that, you can be alone as the captain of a profitable blue ocean yacht. Join us again on Prime for Growth. Prime for Growth is produced by Prime Capital with support of Canadian Western Bank, the bank for entrepreneurs who is obsessed with your success, and the business execution specialists, Results Unleashed, who help you bridge the gap between strategy and execution. Till next time, go forth and innovate.